Lassity go.
Okay. So today we're talking about education and the future of education and how just the way our culture is progressing is affecting that and vice versa, and technology and new laws and all that other stuff, internet in the classroom and group work versus individual work and learning how to network with people and all that other happy stuff. So, does anyone want to start? Do we want to go around and introduce people?
Let's do the introductions. Yeah. This is Willow, our fearless leader. And I'm Rob.
No, I'm another Rob. Or Robert, actually. Yeah. Josh.
Indigo.
Yeah. And Song Kim.
Sarah. Jen.
Brian.
Yay.
Gwen.
Hi, Gwen. Cool. So, does anyone have any starting thoughts on this, as I'm clearly scattered right now?
Well, a friend of mine posted, unrelated to this group, a TED talk about education and how it kills creativity. Just to summarize, if aliens came to our planet and saw our education system, they would think that its purpose was to create university professors because it emphasizes academia. He believes that creativity should be valued just as much as literacy. It should be taught with the same value as it is our schools. They seem to value, we have a hierarchy with mathematics and literature at the top, and then the humanities below that, and then the arts at the bottom. And even within the arts, we put fine arts at the top and other things like dancing at the bottom. And our education system emphasizes the idea that failure is the worst thing that can happen to you. Not to suggest that failure is necessarily creative, but if you're afraid to fail, you will never be creative. So there you go.
I disagree with the point of literacy. I think we found out in the healthcare debates that literacy is really important to a functioning democracy, much more so than creativity. Mm-hmm. While you need creativity to make policy, in order to understand policy, you really need literacy.
Can you teach creativity?
Well, you can nurture it, or you can squash it out.
And they're not mutually.
You can fail to nurture it.
I agree with that.
I think it's an acquired skill that one can create an environment in which that skill can be honed.
It can be socially reinforced into repeating and growing.
About the creativity, now there are two kinds of leadership. One is a functional, traditional leadership. The other one is a thought leader. That's basically a creative leader. And one is a builder or functional, the other one is an architect. So, polarity, it's grand psychology. There are two kinds of human. One is a builder type, the other one is architect or teacher. The feminine type and the masculine type. And the future of society is how we can balance these two, leader type and functional leader type. And in this group, I am trying to be a thought leader. I am very serious transhuman demonstrator, embodiment, and I am official futurist. And I am a trans-level scholar. So for me, I envision sometime in the future within this group dynamics, I want to be the thought leader, group leader. Not as functional, but as content leader. And I go some different groups and I try to be a content leader, whether it's a spiritual group or whatever group.
So do you think that schools should create leaders? Or what is the purpose of
leader
education?
Leader is a general term, but the present university forgot about wisdom. Wisdom is the integration of research activity. The present university produces PhD, which is the research degree. So research. But there is a problem of present university model, which is just a PhD and doing science, doing. But nobody is doing the meta level of integration, which is wisdom level. So to do that is necessary to be creative. So I am combining that level, meta level, and this is a whole new concept. And I want to be a leader at that level, whether it's a university or a small informal group like this. But unless it is recognized.
Okay, so what are other people's views on what education should produce?
Well, the short one, you know, Mark Twain's thing about I never let schooling get in the way of my education.
Yeah.
And that's a profound concept because it says, are we considering education only in the context of schools? I mean, that's not so radical an idea. In the age of Google and other things now, there are other very powerful learning tools available. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that schools are going to have to morph along with the people.
I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, we've seen a groundswell in Japan and Iran and Germany of young liberal voters who are very well informed.
Right.
And it's because the education that they've had that's been typically knowledge-based, they don't really need anymore because they've got an infinite amount of knowledge at their fingertips through the internet. And I think the question is, do we even need schooling anymore, or do we just need a basic literacy over research and what to believe and what not to believe?
What about
credibility?
What about learning what's right and wrong, moral reasoning and philosophy, and a better understanding of yourself and other people?
I don't think that needs to be taught. I think that comes intuitively to each person.
And it might not be schooling as such. It might be the same thing with a group. You know, I mean, I agree with that. That could be something you learn as a peer group thing. It could be a parental thing. But you don't necessarily need a physical school.
Although there was a case last week in Montreal that said that you need to teach several religions.
Mm-hmm.
You can't teach none, and you can't teach one. You need to teach
but
huh,
I do
multiple,
feel like
which I do see some value to that.
We need a structure discussion and class of, you know, moral reasoning of what's right and wrong, especially when we have all these new technologies coming out. You know, what's the right way to develop humanity?
So in studies that have been done of what school actually does,
yeah.
So it doesn't... It's been shown even before the age of the internet, TM, that school doesn't really teach you anything that you're not going to learn on your own.
Right.
What it teaches you is how to socialize.
Right.
How to act correctly for your class and your stature. Because people who are from good neighborhoods live there because their parents can afford to, which means they're socialized with other kids whose parents can afford to live there.
Josh and I are both frowning at this. Did you learn anything about socialization from school? Because it screwed me up. I don't know about you.
Well, no, I think that it
well,
definitely...
Well, that's learning, though. You didn't screw you up.
Well,
I mean, you learned a different lesson than you may have wanted.
I learned an entirely negative and wrong
communication. I know what you mean.
Style,
right. I share that.
I think that, speaking for myself, I won't speak for any studies, but speaking for myself, there are certainly things... There were facts and there were activities and there were a lot of things that I learned through the public education system. In addition to learning some social things and some moral lessons as well. Some of those were intentional and some of them, you know, were playground lessons, we can call them, something like that. But I don't know. I mean, any more than that's going to be a tangent, but I just, like I said, just speaking for myself, I mean, I think that there is value in the education, and the one thing that I would like to see in education is teaching that value. I took public education for granted at its and didn't appreciate it, and now that I'm more involved in a lifelong learning process, I realize how much I could have learned in elementary and middle and high school if I had been interested in learning at that time. I wasn't interested in learning then, though. I was interested in playing. And I think that a lot of my disinterest had to do with the institutional structure. This is, which, you know, people complain about all the time now.
I think there needs to be more of a kind of advertising on the part, especially public schools, for Like, why, like, why you want this? What are you going to do with this? Like, look what you can do with this if you know, if you have this power. Like, it was never, ever sold. Not just, you know, knowledge, you know, having, knowing stuff already is less and less important, but knowing how to get knowledge, what knowledge I want, and how to use it to get what I want, that's power. And education was never, ever sold to me by anyone as power or a tool. It was sold to me as the thing I'm supposed to do because I fucking told you so,
right?
You know? And I think that's a big problem. If, you know, especially if you tell kids that, no, you're not allowed to know this. Well, okay, I guess so. Like, then everybody would be all over that.
Right.
I like that idea a lot.
I think you've got a really interesting point there in that the acquisition or ways to acquire knowledge are more important than the knowledge itself. A lot of traditional teaching, industrialized teaching, was teaching a particular skill, a way to stay involved or directly focused on one task. I think what education needs to do now is move towards teaching people how to acquire knowledge upon their own, how to investigate things differently, so that the focus has changed to skill sets as opposed to knowledge scarcity.
The only thing I would add to that is I think it is important to be able to once you have that access, to be able to do something. You know, I know people who are very good at getting information, and I know people who are very good at retaining information, and the people who are very good at retaining information are often the people that I go to for information because they already have it.
Do you go to people for information anymore? I don't.
To people? Yeah, all the time. For my job, for example, I communicate with 2-3 dozen people every day, and you know, I need somebody who knows this part of the system. I need somebody who knows that part of the system. I don't want to go to somebody who knows how to get somebody who knows that part of the system. I want to go to the person who knows it, and I want to go to the person who knows it really well. And so it's not just about being able to get that information. It's, you know, there's something to be said for people who have experience and have that knowledge inherently within them at that point.
I think that's important also. I've said this before, but another version of it, that to separate out education from schooling is really helpful if we're looking at where it's going in the future.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, they were so mated that it was hard to separate, but it's easier now, as you know, pointed out about self-learning,
mm-hmm.
and after a certain point of literacy, assuming you're interested, then you go learn. If you're not, why should you be dragged to a physical institution?
Well, I think that it's important as far as socialization goes, because especially as reclusive as our family units are now, or tend to be, and I think that, I'm not sure how I feel about Seattle in this. Like, if Seattle tends more towards that or more away from it, because there are people who are really into communal living and like being friends with your neighbors and stuff like that. But it's also a city where you don't want to let your kid go around the block necessarily, depending on how old they are.
Right.
And so, if you want your kids to interact with other kids, the easiest way to do that is to send them to school, is to send them to daycare, is to send them somewhere where it's classified for other kids to be. And then what do you do if you want everybody to interact? Well, you give them projects. Well, they're learning from the projects, and so then it's a kind of school. So my personal...
How far would you take that?
Well, I've seen things like, there's a high school that's, my friend Kellen went to it. It's basically like, you build your own class structure. And so the kids who go there want to be there, because they've decided what they want to learn, and they teach each other too. It's like, I know how to do this. Is anybody interested in learning it? And then they learn what it's like to be a student and a teacher, and that helps build respect. And there are kids that, you don't have to go to class every day, but these kids do because they want to be there. And I think that that's a very important lesson that a lot of us missed out on during our period of schooling, which is you have to be there or you fail. And yes, it's good to learn how to tough stuff out, like to show up even if you don't want to, but I think that there's also something to be said for finding something that brings you enough joy that you want to go there and you seek it out and you learn to have joy in learning something new.
I think it should be fun, no doubt. Yeah. Education should always be fun. And all the things that I do now that are educational, I do because I have passion for them. I love doing them.
That's why it's such a big thing about adult learning. That's why I was asking about the age, is because often adults have much more affinity and are interested in certain things and they're going to study them versus things being thrown at you to become a generalist, maybe before you're even ready or interested.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, again, a trade-off between the amount of time you spend in school versus learning. And I mean, I grew up in a much more severe time than now, which is a lot more flexibility just within the
I think it goes back, especially in higher education, to the institution in which you're dealing with. If you are working with a land grant based institution, it is going to be that research driven, just get your PhD, become an expert, and be a specialist for the rest of your life. In which case, those are becoming quickly obsolete because we research our own stuff and specialists merely write the articles or figure off things on Wikipedia. Or that people, practitioners, rip off and utilize and then give you actual practice and theory application. Liberal arts institutions are very different in that it is that more fun and they teach you how to research and how to synthesize information. However, what they don't teach you is then how to apply it because you can't get a job, you just have an English in liberal arts degree. Like, it's that's the running joke of liberal arts.
One thing that's been mentioned is that it's way too expensive to get to just get an English degree or just get a philosophy or history degree when people who do go into those, sometimes they are actually, they know what they're doing. They know that the degree isn't going to help them, and yet they do want to pursue those knowledge and that interest. So I believe that, you know, that system of, you know, one department kind of almost subsidizing another is broken. Like, I don't think people should pay that much for an English degree versus, say, a law degree.
No, I think that's very interesting. I think one of the things that we're teaching with the cost of education is indentured servitude.
Yeah.
We're teaching a society that once you have some basic skills and some basic knowledge about the world, you're already $250,000 behind in the world, and that you're beholden to either a set of corporations or others in order to just break even. And that's a very new development in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
I seriously think that the education up to college level should be subsidized in some way.
Right.
And in some countries they aren't.
Mm-hmm. You almost have to ensure that if you want to have any kind of literate population.
Right, especially in democracy, it's almost necessary.
Well, and we're also requiring higher and higher degrees for people. Like, education is inflating, where it used to be if you had a high school diploma, like, you can do anything, and now it's, well, then it was, you have to have a high school diploma, and you probably need a bachelor's degree, and now you almost need a master's if you really want to do anything high-end, and most people can't afford it, because, you know, or they spend the rest of their lives working it off, and like, then why did you do it? But then we have people, and this is something that really fascinates me, is I think one of the things that the evolving of software has done is that it's reminded us that it's okay to be self-taught. A lot of the people who are really into software and do really well don't have those degrees because they didn't exist. And so suddenly, you're like, wait. Yeah, and still don't. And they're trying in some places, but they're not useful. Like, yeah, they know how to tag their code, but they don't
know.
You can't get
a PhD in Ajax.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think that that has forced us to remember that maybe it's not necessary for a lot of things.
It's definitely not in software. I know a couple of people earning close to six figures in software who didn't even graduate high school because
mm-hmm.
they got a job at a software company before they got out of high school, and they were, fuck this, I'm going to go in the real world and start really learning.
But now some of the best access to emerging technology is in some schools, where if you go to a really nice school, you have access to touch screens that you wouldn't have in your everyday interaction. I mean, like, here in Seattle, we're all spoiled by our iPhones and our ATMs and our... But, I mean, in Indiana, if you want to have access to high-end technology, you have to go to a boarding school. And that's the only way you're going to be able to interact with that stuff, which is going to give you that foot in the door at other places.
If you want access to lots of information, too, like if you want access to scholarly journals, it's a lot of money unless you're part of a higher institution that already has access to that.
You also have difficulty writing papers unless you're associated with an academic institution, or at least getting them published.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I think it will be interesting to observe how it's going to change, because science is pretty much organized like church right now. You are one of the servants, so you know well. So yeah, I hope that in future, at least with the technology, it's going to be more open so that anyone can write a paper without being affiliated with an advisor who is really well known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are two trends. One is like a good scenario. The other one is very repressive monopoly of knowledge industry by academics, mm-hmm. Academia. And there is a great threat right now in worldwide toward that trend, you know, the power, knowledge power, infrastructure, concentrating power in itself. And the journals and the you know, public information become concentrated in academia, and intellectual habits and have not. That's a great polarization trend, and the World Bank is very worried about this issue, because it's related to the development of nations.
There's another trend though, that's a greater popularization of knowledge on the internet, where everybody can write a blog and they can also be very well informed with what's going on in the sciences. And I would say that more people read those blogs than the actual academic papers, even though the blogs aren't, you know, officially sanctioned by the academic community. They're reaching out to a lot more people.
In the sense that there are academics who write blogs who link to things, which gives them credibility and essentially vouch for what this person said, even though they don't have a degree, I have a degree, and I trust them, and I believe what they say.
Right, but who has the more influence, right? The blogger?
You know, the blogs and the external sites. Last year at Seattle U, the law school, they published 2 journals, 24 articles, nobody reads any of those articles. There was one report that they did with a nonprofit, hate-free zone, now called For America or something. They took that report, put it up online for free. It was on the detention facility here in Tacoma, where we take anybody we pick up at the borders and leave them there without due process indefinitely. That got international coverage because it was available online, free. You didn't have to go to a paywall. You didn't have to be part of the ivory tower to read it. And it got a lot of coverage. Now, the articles that were in those 2 locked journals weren't all bad. Lots of them were very good, but nobody had access. So I think you're right that if you put things out there in an accessible format, it has the ability to influence people widely, where if you put them behind those locked paywalls you were talking about, they just rot.
Now, the trick there is trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because now we have to teach people to distinguish for themselves. If you can't just go online and trust that everyone is an expert, we have to teach people to distinguish between what is good information, what is bad information. And I like the idea that it puts the responsibility back on us as the consumers of that information and the appliers of that information to say, is this really, you know, does this sound like bullshit or not? And do, you know, can I do my own fact checking? Can I do my own, you know, can I apply it? You know, can I build that kit or whatever? And then does it work the way the guy said it does? Or does it, you know, does it really transport me through time, or does it just burn my nuts? You know?
That's what we need to teach, is a bullshit detector.
Well, I think it's already happening because through the wiki, because you always need a bullshit. I mean, you need bullshit protectors with, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica just as much as you do Wikipedia, but people didn't have that because, you know, somebody wrote in a book, so it's true. And now, you know, the ultimate authority on all knowledge is Wikipedia, and nobody believes Wikipedia for everything it says, which is great because that means nobody believes everything they read. Well, yeah. A lot of people do.
And there are a lot of references.
Yeah.
The nice thing about it is the format, right, opens you up to, if you do want the depth,
mm-hmm.
it's
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
So you can entertain the argument.
One good thing about scientific journals are that they are peer-reviewed in the science community. Whoever is publishing the journal, they have this like committee status to publish or supposedly to be published paper. So I think it's going to emerge eventually when you are going to have peers reviewing, and they will review things, and their credibility is going to be just like in a network fashion flow through the whole system. So if someone credible says something about someone, that person becomes a little more credible, and when he reviews something, then you will be able to see that, okay, so this review is trustable.
Mm-hmm. Right now there's an open access journal called PLOS that does that, so they're, since they don't have any money to pay people to be editors and reviewers, they just take a paper that has been accepted and they put it up and anybody can view it. And then there's just a big comment thread about it that goes for like a week or something, and everybody argues over it and talks about it, and eventually some moderator reads all the argument and decides whether or not it's acceptable.
What
or
was
not.
The name of that site?
PLOS.
Public Library of Science.
Nice. Okay.
PLOS.
PLOS.
Public Library of Science.
And you see that on blogs,
that's
right?
Great.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, every WordPress blog has a comment section. You
right.
see people post. That's correct.
Right.
You know, like, or you got this little
Public
fact wrong. Actually, if you go to this link, you'll see that it's like this.
Yeah. So instead of being peer, well, it is still
everybody's
peer reviewed
peers.
Because
yeah.
it's amateur. It's done for the love of doing it. It's not done by people who don't know what they're doing. It's, I mean, that's the original meaning of amateur: is someone who does it because they love it, not because they're doing it for money. And so,
on the internet, people love to be right.
It's true. They do.
I've heard that there's a private high school here in Seattle, Lakeside, which, did Baron leave?
Baron did not come up today, but yes,
okay.
He went there.
That actually teaches internet research,
uh-huh.
about how to determine the credibility of items on the internet, which I think is essential to any high school curriculum.
Well, that's
mm-hmm.
great.
Yeah.
Well, I went to public high school, and I had a high school civics class that was awful, but the one good thing is that we did learn the importance of sourcing all of our information. Now, actually evaluating those sources, that had to come later. But I noticed while reading Wikipedia, discovering Wikipedia over the last several years, I was able to find an article where I was able to correct some of the factual errors, but in order to do that, I had to know more about the subject than whoever wrote the article. And that's not the case. Most of the time, I'm looking up something because I don't know about it. So, of course, now you have to be careful if you see a lot of footnotes, and if you can check the footnotes, then that's helpful.
Well, and we also, to go on a bit of a tangent, if anybody's read House of Leaves, just because there's a footnote doesn't mean that it's credible.
Right.
Like,
no, you follow the footnote and then
right.
see what that says.
You can't just see that it has credits done and references. You have to actually look to see that the reference says what they think it does, because there's too much out there to make sure everybody's using your literature correctly.
And there was a great graph that came out a couple of years ago that referenced footnotes of political books on Amazon, and there was like the red section and there was the blue section, and everyone referenced each other, and there was very little cross.
Uh-huh.
So they all have their own studies and their own sources and their own little, you know, spheres of influence and what they believe to be true. And
mm-hmm.
yeah,
plus a lot of knowledge.
They all have valid studies and valid source sites, but just statistics and.
Yeah.
Things are perpetually changing too. I think when we think of facts as sort of permanent, some facts are. I mean, diameter of the Earth, probably pretty close on that. But there's a lot of stuff that's emerging, like transhumanism,
mm-hmm.
where nobody really knows that much about something that hasn't fully happened yet.
Right.
So in a way, we don't have the 2020 historic perspective. We have to kind of be futurists in our thinking. That's a whole thing that is generally not taught,
right.
at least not yet.
No, well, along those lines, when it comes to talking about education at all, I think, you know, Von Forrester said that that education is about learning to ask legitimate questions, and legitimate questions are questions we don't know the answers to. And so much of education, traditional education, is geared towards pumping you full of facts to make you an expert,
right,
rather than teaching you how to figure out things you don't know. And I think that that's something that most of us here have learned to do one way or another, and that we appreciate. I would like to see it more widespread.
So how do you teach that? I mean, if we're gonna maintain an education system in order to socialize our kids, we might as well have
a goal to it. Well, I think the first thing you have to do is teach the value of that, right? You have to make people want to, you know, the reason that the education system works the way it does is because somebody wants it to. Clearly enough people want it to, because it keeps working the way it's been working. And when people want it to work differently, they'll work differently. But I think that as our values change from, you know, if we don't value PhDs so much, then there's not so much need to create PhDs. I don't know that there's not like one way that I can say, well, you know, this is how we're going to teach America, you know, the value of Heinz von Forrester's value of education. But, you know, I think in teaching our children that, and teaching people that we come into contact with those kinds of values, they spread. And, you know, espousing those values in our communications over the internet and things like that.
How about the value in PhD? That's a cultural paradigm issue, and we have to transcend that. You know, right now is the age of science or that kind of thing. In the past, it was the age of religion. One time, and they produce many religious professionals. But some of the research from creativity research community reports that actually the peak point of creative contribution to society is about the college level or graduate level, master's level. But the moment you become PhD, the creative contribution to the world is much diminished. So PhD right now making a reduced creativity and more narrow expertise. So it's good for a certain cultural paradigm. Everybody become a small expert intellectual, But actually the most of the great contributor in science or whatever creative domain is not PhD, but master's level. For example, master or college, a little beyond the college. Einstein don't have PhD, you know that. And Bill Gates don't have PhD. Apple don't have PhD. Even Google founder don't have PhD. This kind of knowledge should be propagated in the public, but public doesn't know this kind of forefront research.
I think you have to propagate the values beyond the initial education. I mean, you think of education or schooling either way, but in terms of it going for so many years, and then people think that that's the end of the learning process, or at least that's often the case. But we're talking about developing and understanding and changing the values we have right now. I mean, looking at transhumanism, going back to the topic, that one way to consider it from an educational point of view is that the values are going to have to be adjusted as we learn more about what we're doing. We're going to be challenged. Is this a good idea? Is that, should we be doing this? Should we not be doing that? And those weren't taught to us. I mean, the thinking process we learned, hopefully. But we have to, you know, you often change values as an adult. I mean, changing your diet, becoming vegan, you know, things like various ways you can make substantial changes in your life as an adult, values change. So I think part of the thing should be an education extension, if you will, where as an adult that there are more things like what we're doing, adult education.
Yeah, I think culturally education is always has my life been presented as it's this thing that you need to go get, and once
right.
you get, then you have it, and then you use it on stuff. And so you have to pick what kind of education you're going to get, because you can only use this kind of education on these sorts of things, rather than education just being a verb and just being a direction that you're going to keep moving. And you're, it's
right.
going to constantly change direction when you need to solve different problems. Because like I'm in the process of getting a PhD right now, and like one thing that I've found so much is that knowing how to solve problems is not that important. It's necessary. There's all kinds of people who can solve problems that you give them. And what's in high demand and what we have a scarcity of is people who know what problems need to be solved
right.
and know what's important. And because there's an infinite number of problems you can think of. You can think of anything to solve and spend the rest of your life trying to figure it out. And what's important is how to discern between the different problems that have the most impact on whatever the big picture it is, which is you need a big picture in the first place to
yeah.
do that. Which
that's
right.
You
have
to start with the vision and then the persistence.
Isn't that also a problem?
What's that?
Isn't that also a problem to be solved?
Yes,
that's
it
the
is
problem.
A problem.
Right.
But
I think a lot of creativity comes from different disciplines coming together who never thought about their own discipline in that different lens before. And I think that's a huge problem with our current management structure, both in nonprofits and in corporations. You have these people who have been there for 20 years, and they've been doing it for 20 years, and they do not let people into the upper management teams, and they've also been doing it for 20 years. And you get these people who are just indoctrinated into the same culture, and there are people coming in at the lower levels who have really good ideas, who have really good concepts of how to change the industry. I'm sure there are, you know, ad sellers and newspapers who know exactly what the newspapers are doing wrong, right? But they're never going to listen to what they have to say.
When you can tell that they gave the intern the chance to do the headline, and there was like a squirrel carrying
right.
a cup somewhere, and it said one squirrel, one cup. It's like, you know, they gave the intern that one.
And they didn't know that there
yeah.
was sexual innuendo there.
Yeah. Like, the people who usually write
right.
the headline and we were like, squirrel steals cup, what do shit, you know, but now there's a laugh in it. That was kind of a tangent, but sorry.
I think on the issue of values, like, and problem solving and what problems are to solve, I mean, I think going beyond just like what's happening in the schools, I think we need forms, democratic forms, for determining what it is that we want to do with education. I attended the NASA Space Education Conference thing that was here a couple of years ago, and there was a lot of people that were really concerned about the lack of interest in science and math in public schools right now. Now, granted, a lot of these people are coming from backgrounds that are very traditional, and they want to perpetuate those traditions quite a bit. But you know, access to information aside, like it's a pretty big deal to send people into outer space, as an example. Like, you have to have people who know what they're doing that. And if that's something that we want, we need a way of producing people that are able to do that. And I think that we can change how we're doing that. I think it'd be great if people were building rocket ships in their backyard, and you know, going wherever those take them. But I don't know how viable that is. I do know that, you know, people who put a lot of time into learning math and physics and astronomy and stuff were able to do some pretty incredible things. And you know, when it comes to having that depth of education and not just the breadth of education, we need to be asking ourselves, what is it we want to have a depth of education for? What do we want to do? You know, and then how do we produce the people to do that?
How do you produce the teachers to do that?
Right.
Because if the teachers just have their bachelor's in general studies chem, they're not going to be the chemistry teachers that are going to inspire that sort of knowledge seeking either.
Right.
$20,000 a year doesn't give you that sort of knowledge seeking initiative, let me tell you. So I think that you also have to change the education system if you're thinking about the institutional way of doing that.
That's a good point, because if you're not rewarding people, you're not going to see that expansion. It's kind of like one of the features, I'm not sure features is a good word, but one of the descriptors of our culture is we know the price of everything and the value of nothing, as often been said. Mm-hmm. And that's an important insight into the wealth of knowledge about how to do processes and so forth. That's another way of saying the price of something. But whether it's worth doing at all,
right?
You know, container after container coming, you know, from China of stuff that's going to end up in the landfill in a very short time. You know, is that a, you know, a good thing? And so just going into the value system again is really the heart of future education.
I have had instructors, though, that were paid very little who were very inspiring and inspired.
True.
And I've also had professors that were paid entirely too much money and shouldn't have been on tenure and were not inspiring at all.
Right.
So even that is a question in and of itself. With we're now used to giving feedback for things. Like, we give feedback for Netflix, we give feedback for Amazon, we give feedback for eBay. Where are the student systems of rating their instructors, and like, how do you deal with something like tenure, which is necessary if you want people to stick around and want them to do research for you and want them to pursue the building of new papers so that the amateurs have something to reference, like, and build on and give people the space they need to delve into that deep of a concentration, but still balance that with students who like them, and not just because they let them get out early every day to go drinking, but inspire them to do more stuff.
Yeah, that was one thing that I observed in my university education, that usually people become a professor because they are good researchers, but you know, they also are asked to lecture as well. And at least in the university that I was, it doesn't really matter if he cannot really teach anything. He doesn't have the education for teaching to start with.
Mm-hmm.
He just happens to be a really good researcher, and now he's trying to teach us, and he's definitely a good researcher, but he lacks being able to make people inspired.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that the university should hire lecturers and researchers and separate them? Or how should it proceed?
I think the university structure itself should open. Like, if you have an open university type of structure where people are actually, anyone can actually start create lecture material, which will be of course peer reviewed by anyone, then what will happen is you will have really great lecturers which are going to be accessible for other people, and then eventually people can learn from them and then move on and become good researchers and be on the very fringe.
There is a university, I should look up the name of it, but as a student you're allowed to present a curriculum that you would like to teach, or that somebody else has agreed to teach, and if it gets enough people signed up for it, then you teach the class. And so there was a really cool one I heard about from a gentleman that kept taking gender studies classes, and he was like, this is not gender studies, this is women's studies, I want to tell you about what it is from the man's perspective, and like, what it is to be a privileged white male, and why I'm not apologetic. Like, I'll help you out in your plight, but I'm not going to apologize for what people like me did 200 years ago. And that was the class. And that's awesome, and people loved it, and after he was done at school there, he had the option of either coming back and teaching it and getting money for it, or teaching someone else how to teach that class, because there was such a demand for it. Like, how do you deal with being in a state where you should be apologetic, like, without apologizing? Like, how do you actually do things?
It's a great system. What school is it?
I have no idea, but I'll find out. In fact, I'll send it to
high school. I went to a college that was like that called Ben Salem. It only existed for a short time because it was at Fordham University in New York, a Jesuit university, and
uh-huh.
You couldn't believe what they had unleashed. It ran for only 4 years, the whole process. But you designed your own curriculum. I was involved in housing and environmental psychology, so I ended up doing a lot of stuff at other locations. Only some of it I've been upset. So some people would go and enroll in another university to take certain courses.
Very cool.
Basic coursework. So and this is a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's some similar stuff, right? Evergreen State College allows you to design that. In fact, it's one of the few places I know of you can get a second hand situation.
True.
Yeah.
And but I mean that all comes down to choice, right? Like, you know, giving people, you know, options and letting people specialize in what they want to specialize in and not select the best category that's kind of close to what they want to do with their lives.
Because you may not know.
Or you may know. You may exactly know.
But you're going to change at some later point. So you need flexibility in how you...
Well, sure. But I mean, but even I'm just saying, you could even know right from the get-go, and
right.
That's not... And there's no avenue for that. Like, you know, like...
As more non-traditional age students are applying to and going to college, there's actually been a major increase in what's being called the academic swirl. Students are starting at community schools and going to major universities and ending up in private schools and coming back to community schools because they're looking for that specialization and difference in approach and curriculum. And it's becoming much more common, and a lot of land-grant universities are freaking out because it's a huge upset in retention and processes that they go through for evaluation.
Well, they're going to go through the same bricks and mortar, and they are going through that any other that retailers have gone through.
Mm-hmm.
You need a net presence, not just as a symbolic thing, but the heart of the program. And a lot of universities have adopted that, actually, right? Because they want any kind of outreach, international, or even domestic.
Another thing I would like to see related to that is, for example, I don't have any college credit whatsoever. And if I wanted to go get a degree at this point, I'd have to start from the beginning. And there's something to be said for that. I understand why we have standards, but I would love to be able to... What am I trying to say? You know, in the 15 years since I graduated high school, you know, accumulated quite a bit of information, and I've done quite a few things, and I'm pretty competent at a lot of things, and I don't think that I really need to take a lot of the things that I learned in college in order to do what I want to do at a bachelor's degree level or a master's degree level in whatever area that I want to work in, right? Certainly, I would want to learn more than I know now. That would be my reason for going back to school. But it would be nice if there was some way to. I know, for example, you can take, I forget the name of it now, but you can take tests and stuff to test your knowledge and things. But again, you have to test in things that really don't have anything to do with what you want to do. You know, I might have to take English credits to get, you know, if I want to just improve my computing degree or something.
Yeah, but that has to do with what values we're wanting to instill in people. It's like, we want to be able to all read and write in similar fashion so that we can better understand each other.
Absolutely.
And because school is the only place that we've really done that, until we figure out another way to socialize people outside of that or have testing to show, look, I can write and communicate with people, like I don't need this English class, then so that goes back to school being about socialization.
Yeah, it is about socialization, because a degree from college is so much more than I've acquired this knowledge or I've acquired these skills. It's I can be held accountable for a certain amount of structure of, I come here every day on a certain times, and then I do tasks by certain deadlines predictably, and I do them well. And here's a piece of paper that shows that I can do that. I can do it for you too. That's the biggest point of a degree in my mind.
There are a lot of master's programs that will take your work experience into consideration in granting up to half of that program. I don't know if there are bachelor's programs that do the same thing, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I heard there are. They're life experience credits, in effect, versus testing specifically.
Especially for some of your elective type things that are cool.
Absolutely. Colleges need money now, too. They're amenable to all sorts of deals.
So the school that I referenced earlier, I got the text back, is Oberlin, which I don't know where that is.
Ohio,
sweet.
Has an amazing music school.
Nice.
Oberlin.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it sounds like what we're talking about is instilling a desire to figure things out. And I assume, even though we haven't really talked about it, an ability to interact with others and, like, work on things with other people. We haven't really talked about that, and I would like to, but
sure.
The other thing that that it seems we're trying to do with the education system, or where we see it going, or where we hope to, is individualization and having that joy in learning the thing that you want to learn, whether it's really specific or I just want to know more about this computing language. Like, I know that's pretty specific as well, but just in general, not even to make it do a specific thing, but I want to learn more about hardware. Like, how do I do that? And so it seems like it's becoming a place you go to talk to people who already know about it, and not a place that is so rigidly structured, if that makes sense.
I'm not sure if you necessarily have to go. I mean, I think right now that's a good option, or probably the main option. But I think in time, we're going to find classes or affinity groups that cross national lines. We might be sitting here with our various equipment and talking to people in Mongolia and somebody in Tunisia and somebody in France. And it's all part of they all have a common interest in something. By then, we may have better language translation. You know? And so a lot of this may end up being that we have a class of the future. Maybe across all sorts of lines that in the past would have been strictly geographical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're in this district, but now, say, the world is at this district. So that changes immediately what your image of the school.
So along those lines, now we have to not just worry about working with the people around you, that in small towns you kind of have to learn how to do anyway,
right.
But how do you cross cultural boundaries to work with people that don't
right.
have the same ideals that you do? How do we teach people to work together?
That's a great value of having a large, diverse environment like a liberal arts college, where people can come together and work on something that is beyond any individual can figure out. That's, you know, from my experience in high school, everything could be figured out on my own. You know, I never learned how to work with other people until first year in college, where, bam, there's a problem that I don't know how to solve, and it's not on the internet, and it's not in any books. What do I do about it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I go up to people and work together with them and ask the right questions and contribute in a meaningful way in a group? I don't think that's something that you can learn on your own. Or maybe in a work environment you can do that, right? But still, you know, that's what education is about, is to prepare you for work environments where what you do actually matters instead of, you know, homework problem.
I think collaboration is one aspect, people getting together and trying to solve a problem together, whatever the incentive is, most probably shared. But then there's also like the master and the pupil type of thing, where you want to learn something you don't know too much about, and there's a person who knows less about it. How are you going to reach it? Maybe you can, you know, reach it through the internet or some other information channel, but then the other person on the other end of the pipe needs to be motivated. Personal appreciation, like, oh, you are going to be called the most knowledgeable person in this field, it goes so far, like, needs to be somehow like funded. Of course, like, if I'm sitting on a terminal and teaching people how to write program, you know, how am I going to get money for it? How am I going to get fund? Maybe I can have a website to have advertisers on. Something
meter,
like that.
Basically, you know, you get paid piecework. I would predict in the future, check this out, that a lot of us are going to earn money in little pieces from all sorts of places that aggregate in special accounts. The reason being that it will be economical to pay people a quarter of a cent for something, if you get enough of it. I mean, I get royalties from various intellectual property things, and in tiny amounts of it. Why would I bother? Pay it up. And if you start to get known and people buy more of your stuff, and after a while. So I suspect that model is pretty good anywhere around the world, because there's going to be more and more internet-enabled people.
Something like a dollar store as a university?
Yeah, exactly.
What?
Like, you know, the $1 stores? You have a university where you only pay $1 for each class you take, or less than a dollar.
Right,
yeah.
We'll get to that. It'll be metered education. I mean, it's not, I've heard people who know a lot more about it than I do, talking about that as viable economic models, maybe for colleges in the future that do an outreach. I mean, you can take Harvard courses anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. That's going.
Well, we already kind of do that with podcasts.
MIT, right?
Yeah.
Distance learning programs in general.
Yeah.
I have a question. I think that a lot of us here got into what we got into because we had some kind of love for it. That may not be all of us. But I know a lot, I've worked with a lot of people who got into computers the same way you used to get into banking or something. It was just something to do to make money. And, you know, it didn't used to be that way, but computing's gotten to that point where, you know, somebody has to go to college, or what am I going to do to make $100,000 a year? I'll be a computer programmer. And so how do we allow for that, you know, if we're changing the education system? How do we allow?
That's vocational.
What's that?
There is a place for that now, vocational education, whether it's repairing cars or computers.
Well, there is, but I can tell you, because I have a vocational education.
Oh, okay.
It's vocational education is still not taken nearly as seriously
That's true.
As a degree. And there's something also, again, to be said for going to a liberal arts college and learning something more than just how to work on cars or how to work on computers or whatever. And that's the kind of focus that I loved about the vocational education. But I got my socialization elsewhere. But So what I'm wondering is, I'm thinking a couple of things. One is that if our education system encourages people to pursue their desires more, are we going to have as many people who just want to get whatever job they can get in order to get by for the rest of their life?
I think there will still be openings for things like that.
And if there are, how do we accommodate that?
I don't even think ideally it can all be like self-motivation, passion-based and work very well. Because like a big part of education, at least for me, but I think this is general, is not just acquisition of information and not just understanding the skills, but actually developing the skills. Like math isn't something that you just learn and then you know it. It's a skill that you get good at it, and if you stop doing it, you get bad at it. If you start doing it and you build it, or just any kind of type of problem solving, a lot of higher education for me was just kind of like boot camp conditioning to just train your mind to do something. And the most obvious way to do that is like by the current system where you have arbitrary tasks and you have to do that, or you don't get the prize at the end, or whatever, but it seems non-ideal.
And along those lines, not besides just having things do what they desire, like I really value classical education. I because everybody I've known that's had a classical education, I see in them so much more potential for excellence than people. And I mean, people who, you know, grammar, rhetoric, arithmetic, you know, and you know, those weren't things that, you know, when, you know, people were 6 years old, they went, I want to learn arithmetic. That was something that, you know, their parents made them learn. Now, there's ways to make that fun, more or less, but you know, at some point, education does have to be pushed. It's not all pull education. And then the question becomes, well, what do we push, and how much do we push?
Do we push the same way that we would have even this year? Are we going to do it 5 years from now? Or will that be irrelevant? That's the hard part, is planning what we're going to do next. I think we're all good at understanding real well all the different parameters, parallel approaches, oppositional approaches, polarization. But at the end of the day, what are the suggestions? I'm just kind of curious what people feel. If you were, you know, in charge of fill in the blank, what would you think is the best thing that could be contributed to future education as opposed to modern as of today?
We can put a poll up on the website or something.
No, I mean you folks here, literally.
Yeah. I mean, after having this talk, like one thing that I want to do after this talk is when I go home, I want to check what are the open accessible peer reviewed systems which are available, where you can peer review anything. And if it is not available, how would it be possible to be done? Because the system can be used to peer review movies, or it can be also used for peer reviewing real articles about science.
I bet you if it's not becoming prevalent already, the people who do the public
library
of science, I bet you they are nerds and awesomely crazy about what they're doing and would love it if people would do it for other things.
Yeah.
That's something that I'm finding about people that build their own stuff, is that they're really excited about it and they don't believe so much in being competitive as other people are, where it's like, I built this cool thing. You can too. Here's how. Like,
right.
we're very much...
Competition's a very business type thing, not so much a science type.
Yeah.
Right. Like, a lot of that competitive attitude came from a business legacy where, you know, you're trying to make more money than the guy next to you.
Yeah.
I think
that's
it also comes from
scarcity model
arrogance,
oriented.
Though.
What's that?
I think it also has deep roots in arrogance. I work at a gifted and talented college, and they don't have grades. It's not about, but they show off about who can sleep the least and study the least and party the hardest.
Right,
and it's
right.
about, I mean, there's always a level of competition, even if it's within a community of academics who just want to be the best because bragging rights.
Right.
Also,
and coming of age is a big reason that we have our contest. You know, who are you in the community now? So,
sure, but
that's a big
right.
part.
But I think that some of that can be moderated through the culture of the institution that you're learning through.
Right.
And you know, good competition can be encouraged and nurtured, and then, you know, where cooperation is more valuable than that.
Well, also about science and business and competition. Well, actually, science right now I think is worse than business because it's also money driven, but worse because there is no checks and balances when it comes to science, which is in here in many other societies, whatever the economic model is.
That's one of the reasons.
Really quick, there was a comic recently actually about, oh, we had this great discovery. We can totally get this published. Well, if we divide it up, we can get published twice. Well, they're making charts of how many times they can publish and still get the most, you know, out of it. And then the final panel is this woman in a hospital bed, and she's like, have they figured out how to cure this yet? And they're like, no, science is a slow process. Like,
yeah.
Well, it is, but you also, like, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of money in being a scientist. There's a lot of money in science, but not necessarily in doing science. And so what you get out of it is the prestige.
Prestige is definitely the money of science, that is the profit of science. You need a lot of money to do it, but it's mostly, you know, the money you get is not for profit. You don't get to buy a new house with your new grant from the NIH.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing some really
good
stuff.
On the other hand, it's patent stuff. I've done mentoring for people who are inventors. And there, a lot of people want that brass ring. And, on one side you could say the competition is good, but on the other hand you could say it's based on an older model of scarcity.
Yes.
Right. Somebody had to win and somebody had to lose. And that may not be what we want to do in the future.
It's not zero sum anymore.
Yeah, we can't afford it.
And
we can't afford to take
I think
people and act that way.
I think the competition in science is like yet another one of those things that does work non-ideally, very predictably. So, I mean, competition always immediately speeds things up a little bit right away, but ultimately it slows everything down because, you know, you have, like, especially with, you know, the increasing number of specialists. So there's, you know, you can think of any obscure problem and there's like 10 people around the world, millions of dollars working on it.
Right.
And so they're all keeping their information from each other and there's all this secrecy going on because there's, like you said, there's a perception there's a general like air of that there's some scarcity of prestige, and so there's not enough prestige to go around, so we need to hoard it and need to try to get it from other people.
And it's the publisher perish problem too. If you're an academic and you're not leading in your field, you may not get tenure. So there are financial considerations.
Yeah, the prestige turns into money. I mean, prestige is the thing you garner, but that turns into your standing, which turns into your paycheck. And
which is why you might get brought in to a project to be a consultant and therefore be part of the patent and make some real money. Sometimes.
Yeah. You're talking like science is like behind closed doors thing.
Yeah.
But it's not. I mean, there are lots of conferences that you can go to. I've been to a few that, you know, people share what they are doing right now in their lab. Mm-hmm. And this is slides that haven't been published yet. Check out my data. And then afterwards, they talk about, you know, give criticisms and talk about, I mean, it's not just, I'm going to get there first by closing my door and you can't see what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's, some people are like that though. Like, I mean, if someone just like gets good friends and starts publishing lots of paper and publishes them such that his work can be not fully reproduced.
Yeah,
he's actually violating the very nature of science, but he can get by in a good university.
That's a risk that the individual lab has to take. Is if I don't share any of my information while, you know, spending 3 years doing this, what if I made a mistake early on and I've been wasting all 3 years?
I mean, you can, for example, when it comes to software, you can publish the runtime results, how the things are acting, but no one asks you to like, okay, I want to get your software, the source code of it, so that I can just replicate the same things easily. But they will say like, no, we will just give you the binary.
Right.
So that you can run and see that it works actually the way it does.
Sure.
But we will just like, you know, tackle your feet over there so that you don't catch us easily.
Yeah, I've been trying to drag some already published information, get the raw data out of it. I've been trying to drag it out of them for like 4 or 5 months, you know, and it's all been funded by taxpayers, like completely public, but they won't give the information over even though they've already published the results because, you know, they think there's more that could be done with it, there's more that can be published with it, and they don't want other people to scoop them.
You have a lot of lawyers who are giving advice also. The other side of this are the lawyers behind the science and the scene, because they're associated with the venture capitalists, institutional investors, the whole crowd of people who put the big money in. And they really run a competitive game.
And
they are not interested in cooperation.
That's where the science intersects with the business, too, though.
That's
right. I mean, that's where you get your science
with
the industrial.
Middle Eastern.
Yeah, when you are doing corporate science, there are many things before you publish it. You know? Some are national security issue internationally.
Right.
Some are related to industrial advantage or patenting process, so they have to give moratorium for 1 year or so and do the patent process. After then, they, you know, can publish, right? But within withholding some of the proprietary commercial value information. So, for example, if I do some energy science research, most of them will be forbidden by the government because it has an international technology transfer nature. So it's, for example, I mentioned a certain future concept to my professor who is a major futurist. And then he to get the permission, official permission from me to quote that kind of a future scenario in his work. So, you know, it's not just a pretty thing. It's
pretty complicated too. And as we go more into the future, you get this phenomenon. Not only are there more people and more patents being created, but there's also more and more prior art, meaning that there's a huge base of stuff that's been done. So part of what I would suggest in future education is a kind of a dual approach. One is for the love of it, and the other is for the love of humankind, if you want to think of it as both a selfish and a selfless.
We should have another group meeting on property.
Good.
Because we had a good one on like copyright and patent law and trademarking and stuff like that. It was like a year ago. It was a while ago. But
it's probably raining. I couldn't go.
But we can do that again. I think it would be good to visit with the.
I want to cover. I want to mention some small issues I am always feeling. No, I want to demonstrate as a transhuman future creative movement. And I am I need a community, and I need support, to actualize my internal architect into proprietary communication stage and to actualization. It takes a process, time. But also I like to freely contribute here as activation also contribution.